So in an asset sale, a buyer typically creates their own corporation or their own LLC, and then they use that new corporation or entity to acquire the business itself. So it's a fresh, clean start in most situations. The buyer's opening up a new bank account under their new corporate name, and then they're buying the assets of the company.
Welcome to the Property Management Brainstorm Show with Bob Preston. Bob is the lead consultant and podcast host at Property Management Brainstorm, the consulting and strategic planning company dedicated to the property management industry. This podcast is for property managers and company owners seeking an in-depth look into current trends toward adding doors, growing recurring revenue, and building a high-profit property management business. You'll hear from leading professionals on hot topics, success stories, and strategies for expanding your company and assuring your property portfolios are managed efficiently. Now, here is your host, Bob Preston.
Hello, brainstormers. This is Bob Preston, your host. Happy to be here today, broadcasting from our Property Management Brainstorm Studio in Del Mar, California. If you're new here, please subscribe so you get ongoing access to all of our great episodes. And if you like what you hear, we would sure appreciate a positive review. Before we get started today, I would like to give a shout out to our amazing industry icon sponsors for helping to support the show: Upkeep Media, SureVestor, VPM Solutions, Second Nature, Showdigs, Blanket, Latchell, APM Help, Lead Simple, and today's feature sponsor, Rentscale, who you will hear more about in a brief mid-roll about halfway through the episode. It's no secret that a lot of consolidation has occurred in the property management industry over the past few years. Whether you want to be acquired or not, as a property management consultant, I always advocate with my clients that they have a succession plan or exit strategy. This provides a roadmap for the business owner to prepare for a transition at some point in the future and also provides staff members with the assurance that the company will be in good hands for many years to come. Preparing your property management company for acquisition is a significant task that involves various strategic, financial, and operational considerations. Believe me, I know this because I've been through it. Today's guest on the show is an experienced business sales advisor, Dylan McGrath of SD Business Advisors. Dylan has been a business broker since 2010, advising companies on selling their businesses. He and I will discuss planning for an eventual sale of the business, preparing your company for a possible negotiation, and the steps involved when going through an acquisition. This is a great episode, so take your time and have a listen. Hey, Dylan, welcome to Property Management Brainstorm.
Hey, Bob. Thank you. Good to see you.
Yeah, very good to see you too. I've been really looking forward to this conversation today because there's been a lot of consolidation in the property management industry. I know you and I chatted about that over coffee a few weeks back, and I'm certain many of our listeners just want to understand how selling their property management business would work, right? So this is great. And I always ask my guests to start by just introducing yourself. So let's roll with that. Why don't you tell us about yourself, your background, your company, and your business practice?
Sure. Yeah, happy to do that. Dylan McGrath. I've been selling businesses for over 13 years now. Company I work with is SD Business Advisors. We're based here in San Diego. We've been in business for about 16 years now. So we have a really great team of, I think we're up to about 18 different advisors who do what I do. I think there's strength in numbers, definitely, and an experience, right? Versus working for a one or two man shop. There's a lot of advantages that I don't think we need to go into right now. Maybe those are things we can share with a potential client down the road. But yeah, that's just a little brief intro to me.
Terrific. Now, you work on the company sales side, right? And I'm going to use a term that our property management and real estate people will understand, kind of as the listing agent, right? I'm a euphemism, but it's like, is that an accurate description of what you do?
Yeah, that's right. We represent the seller exclusively in most of our transactions.
And you've worked with many companies and selling their business. When someone comes to you and says, "Hey, Dylan, I'm thinking about selling my company. You know, would you be willing to represent us?" What's the first conversation you would have with them about that?
Yeah, great question. You know, the first conversation I always tell people, it's a very informal, of course, it's confidential, It's really a two-way interview, right?
Sure.
I'm not interested, and maybe we'll cover this question later. So maybe I'll just get it out of the way right now. You know, I always tell people I only list businesses if I feel there's a very strong probability I'll be able to sell it, right? Mm-hmm. As much as I love what I'm doing, it's, you know, really exciting and I really enjoy it. Obviously, it has its challenges and it's kind of ups and downs and it's roller coasters. That's part of what makes it, you know, interesting and exciting for me. But, you know, we don't charge any kind of monthly retainer. I think it would be very different if I knew I was getting money every month from my client, right? So since that's not the case, I'm highly incentivized to actually take the business to the closing table and go through that whole process. Otherwise, I'm working for free, right? And I've got a wife and four children, and just like everyone, I've got bills to pay. And so my first kind of conversation with them is first and foremost trying to find out a little bit more about them, their situation. Is there a true motivation to sell, first and foremost, and what is that? And then second of all, I'm going to ask them some operational questions about their business. I want to find out more from kind of a 30,000 foot view of what does the business look like currently? And essentially, do I feel like I will be able to find a good, qualified, capable buyer who would be interested in acquiring this type of business? So yeah, that's in a nutshell, that's the first conversation, is really kind of a two-way interview. And mm-hmm. and my first question that I ask myself always is, do I even like this person, right? Do our personalities jive? Up to this point, has their communication flow been good? Or has it been very intermittent and they don't respond to my emails? And, you know, you can kind of see the writing on the wall, I think, in business from someone, if they're going to be a good fit kind of from the outset. And so certainly I will pass on a number of opportunities because they don't fit my criteria.
That completely makes sense. And again, it's not too different from those of us, you know, in the property management industry who are brokers or agents or property managers who have to be really careful about the clients they pick up. I remember, gosh, this goes back about 12 years ago. I tried to buy a business that was up a little bit up the road from us in San Clemente, California. And we got really far into it and the seller just got cold feet and the broker who was representing her was so upset and she just walked away from the whole thing and he was very, very frustrated. So that would be, I guess, the worst case scenario. Someone just changes their mind, right?
It really is. I mean, yeah, it's really kind of a kick in the butt, right? I've invested a lot of time and a lot of money, you know, especially when you bring a good qualified buyer to the table who makes a very fair, reasonable offer. And then the seller gets cold feet. Yeah, it's very frustrating. Yeah. So I'm not trying to tell a seller, hey, sign on the dotted line. Let's get this up and running. Like, there's no rush on my end. I want to make sure that we've checked all of the boxes leading up to it, that the seller's really shown to me and committed that they're motivated to sell if I'm capable of doing what they're hiring me to do.
Okay. So you mentioned, hey, I don't get paid unless the business closes, right?
Yep.
You know, so what are the typical fees and how does it work in representing the seller? I mean, how are you paid and when are you paid?
Great question. A lot of business donors don't understand. They think, well, when I sold my house, I only paid, you know, 5 or 6%, or I know there's discount brokers out there. We aren't a discount broker. For businesses under $1 million in my industry, kind of a industry average is anywhere between 10 to 15%. And that's based on it being a success fee, right? So essentially, we're getting paid 0% if we're not capable of accomplishing, you know, what we're tasked to do with our engagement. We're right in the middle. We charge a 12% fee. Of course, this is 2024, right? If someone's listening to this podcast, in 10 years, maybe industry rates will, you know, go up a little bit. I would imagine, as with everything. But, you know, for businesses under $1 million, I charge a 12% fee. It's 100% success based. Once you get above that range, you know, we're reasonable business people. We work on some sort of sliding scale. So if we did a valuation, we engaged with the client and it was let's say a $3 million sale, we might say, hey, we'll charge you 12% on the first million, 10% on the second, 8% on the third. Or if it's a $10 million business, we may just say, hey, let's just do 6 or 7% kind of across the board at the end of the day, it has to make sense to us and it has to make sense to the seller, where we feel like it's a win-win, right? I'm not here to gouge people, but if people don't see the value in, you know, the service and the expertise that I bring to the table, and their main thing is trying to kind of beat me down on my commission from the get-go, yeah, that's one of those things I can tell. I don't know if they're so worried about the fee and they don't see the value in bringing me in, you know, to make this process happen, then, you know, maybe I'll think twice about engaging with them.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And what about the written agreement between you and the seller? There's got to be some kind of a contract. What does that look like? And is there a typical time that you get to sell the property, right? Is there a timestamp on the contract?
Sure. I think it's very similar to selling a home, which more people obviously can relate to. So we do have a formal listing agreement or an engagement letter. And, you know, really depending on the industry that the business is, how motivated the seller is, really that kind of dictates the time frame. I'm always going to ask for a minimum 6 months just because it takes a while to kind of go through this process. It's not as simple as listing a home, right? Where if you're in a good neighborhood, you've got a home that shows well, you know, it's priced right, you put it on the MLS and you're going to have multiple showings and likely an offer within the first 30 days, right? Assuming the market is, you know, all things considered and it makes sense to buy that home. For businesses, the process does take a little bit longer. So if it's a business that I feel like it's a unique industry that I don't personally within kind of my buyer database or within our company's buyer database, we feel like this one, we just don't know, right? It could sell in 2 months. It could sell in 12 months. On those types of businesses, I typically ask for a 9 to 12 month engagement.
Okay. All right. Now, you kind of alluded to being careful with who you do business with and who you represent and who you bring to market. How much due diligence do you perform in kind of assessing the business before, I guess, taking it on and putting it out for sale? And which aspects of the company are you looking at, like financial, operational, legal, their contract, their client contracts, their scope of services? I mean, these are all things that a buyer would look at. So do you take time before you actually take on a client and doing that? Or is that done pretty much after you've already signed and on your way?
No, it's done before, right? Because like okay. I said, when I'm analyzing an opportunity, the last thing I want to do is rush in to a listing agreement and jump into a working relationship with the client, only to find out later that there's things that are going to pose concerns or red flags for buyers. So once again, really kind of on that initial call, I'm asking more of those operational questions, right? We also have a seller, you know, complete a survey that's going to tell us more, or maybe more of an intake form, you might call it, that asks a lot of kind of these simple questions, right? Yeah, we're going to ask, hey, do you have any kind of legal actions that are pending against you, right? If there are, well, tell us more about that. We need to investigate that a little bit more. Maybe they need to clear things up before we want to put it out in the market, right? Because, you know, good savvy buyers, they don't want to leave any, you know, stones unturned as they're going through their due diligence. And right. so naturally, since I know that I'm not going to be making any money and accomplishing what my clients, you know, hiring me to do, unless we make it to the closing table, on these initial conversations, I very much come to the table with my buyer's hat on. Essentially, I am the buyer. I'm asking questions that I know that buyers are going to be asking, general questions. And also, if it's an industry that I'm familiar with and that I've sold the business in, more industry related questions, right? So I'm really doing my due diligence. Once I go through that initial conversation, if they kind of pass the initial sniff test, if you will, and they do want to take the next step in my process is to put together a business valuation, right? At that point, obviously, I'm requesting financials, typically looking 3 years back to see a little bit of the history of the business. And we put together the valuation. So at that point, I put together a financial review where I'm going to go through their P&L or tax return, you know, line item by line item, trying to identify, you know, are there any, you know, were there any one-time expenses that are not going to be recurring to a new buyer, right? Are there personal expenses or owner benefits, whether that be an officer's salary or, you know, you're paying for your spouse's, you know, car payment, right? Which obviously is not a true business expense, or maybe you pay for your family's, you know, health or medical insurance. We're trying to identify these things in the valuation that aren't, if you want to refer to it as like a true business expense, and then we add those back. So in our industry, you know, as we're doing valuations, we refer to those as add backs, and we're going to add those back to the profit of the business to come to what, you know, we refer to as either the seller's discretionary earnings or the EBITDA of the company. And then typically we're going to base our valuation off of some multiple of that seller's discretionary earnings or the EBITDA.
Okay. All right. One of the things, great segue, and this is all before you've actually signed a contract. Is that right? You would do your initial evaluation?
Correct. We need to make sure that, you know, we're on board with the price. If my valuation comes in at, you know, $3 million and the seller, you know, in their mind, they're not selling for anything less than $5 million, then that's a big gap, right? And so at that point, I would decide, hey, unless they come down to reality or their motivation level changes,
right,
they're not a client for me at that time.
Typically, is that the model you will stick with, is EBITDA times some sort of industry multiple that you're applying?
For the most part, yes. And the reason being is because buyers look at acquiring a business as with any investment, right? How much is it going to cost me to secure this investment or to buy this business? And how long is it going to take me to recoup, you know, my money on that investment.
Right.
So if you're looking at it solely from a revenue perspective, you can't answer that question, right? If you're basing on that, there are certain industries where, and, you know, within the property management industry, I mentioned to you, I've sold a number of property management companies over the years. I've done dozens of valuations, you know, for property management companies. And it really depends on the buyer. If it's an industry buyer who already knows what their costs are, right? If they're doing $1 million in revenue, they have a ballpark idea of what their costs are and what their, you know, bottom line profit is going to be for that business. So an industry buyer may be more concerned with that top line revenue and base their valuation off of that. Or, you know, some buyers base their valuation off of, you know, a multiple of, for property management companies, a multiple of your recurring, you know, revenue. And so there's a few different methodologies. I would say 90% of the time, you know, kind of across the board industry wide, people are looking at that bottom adjusted net profit and they're applying some multiple of earnings to that figure.
Yeah, absolutely. So you know this about me. I've been through it. I sold my business to a company called Pure Property Management. I talked to everybody that I could in the industry who I knew was acquiring companies. Now, these were national property management companies that were rolling up doors, you know, so a little bit different. I would say at least half were using the EBITDA model that you described, right? Others were like, well, look, we'll worry about your profit and loss and efficiency later when we have your doors on board, because we know, being in the industry, we have processes and procedures that can gain efficiencies, and we'll take care of that maybe a little bit later. And so some of them were just based on revenue, like top line revenue. They put a multiple to that. So it's really interesting. And then there were some others who were just like, oh no, we just want your doors. We're just buying your contracts. We'll pay you X number of dollars per door or per property contract, right? So that was the other thing that I found, is those three methods. But I think the most common, you're right, I think, is the EBITDA model.
Yeah. And once again, the property management industry it's interesting, right? There's other industries that I do, you know, a lot of work in as well. You know, I tend to work a lot in service related companies, right? Mm-hmm. And so I've sold a fair number of IT service companies, which same thing, there's a big recurring revenue model there, right? Especially for managed services providers. You know, janitorial commercial cleaning type companies, same things. You have these contracts that you're going in, if it's whether it's an office building or industrial space, you know, you're charging them X amount of money every month. So there's a recurring revenue model. I really like that because buyers really like that. And there's a lot of buyers out there. So that's why I tend to specialize in, you know, certain service related companies.
Sure.
And, you know, with these types of models, it's becoming, you know, less and less common for a buyer to come in who's not an industry buyer, someone who's just, you know, maybe they're an ex-executive and they've made other companies a lot of monies over the years. And they're at the point now in their career where they're, you know, maybe 50 years old and they're like, hey, you know, over the last 20 years, I've made good money. I've stashed some money aside. I've had experience in marketing. I'm a good manager. I'm good at customer service. Very well-rounded people who want to kind of jump in and become an entrepreneur and buy a business. For them, it's very difficult to compete with a good industry, like you said, maybe a national property management buyer, because the transaction is so much easier with the larger company because they know exactly what they're looking for. They're asking all the right questions, and they're just, in most cases, they're an easier buyer to work with.
Well, they're probably a faster sale for one thing, right? And then I'm curious, are most of your transactions asset sales, or do you ever do like the full stock sale, buy the whole company, the whole corporation?
I would say majority of the time they're asset sales. It's kind of hard to say, hey, 7 out of 10 or 9 out of 10, sure, but you know, somewhere kind of in that range, I'd say 75% are asset sales. Oftentimes, if you have a larger company, like I mentioned, you know, property management company where you have contracts in place, buyer and seller may decide, hey, it's just easier to do a stock sale. That way we don't mm-hmm. have to reach out to every one of our, you know, clients, have them sign new contracts before closing. So, you know, in industries like a property management company or a couple of the other ones that I've mentioned where you have contracts, recurring revenue, it's, you know, maybe it's more of a 50-50 where you do see more stock sales happening. Sure. But I'd say in general, we primarily kind of in the smaller business space where we're under 20 million in revenue companies, we see more asset sales than stock sales.
You know, it might be helpful too for our listeners because we're using these terms. We know them. Our listeners may not be used to them. So maybe describe the difference between an asset sale and a stock sale.
Yeah, happy to. I found that too. So the question is, in a stock sale, the buyer actually is buying that entity, right? So they're not only buying the, you know, the business itself, they're buying the entity or the stock within the company. One question you may have, so maybe I'll just kind of chime in here, is, you know, do I see buyers sometimes, you know, just saying, hey, we want to acquire 90% of the corporation and we want the seller to still have some ownership in the company? Mm-hmm. I think that was one of your questions that I kind of read. And so the answer to that is it's very rare that we see that happen. Most of the time, a buyer doesn't want to, you know, allow the seller to retain ownership because really they're kind of strangers, right? And they don't want to mm-hmm. jump into bed or jump into business with a stranger where, you know, they don't know what that relationship, working relationship is going to look like. And so that's a stock sale, right? With a stock sale, buyers don't want to do a stock sale because they are inheriting the liabilities of the corporation. So, and with an asset sale, a buyer typically creates their own corporation or their own LLC, and then they use that new corporation or entity to acquire the business itself. So it's a fresh, clean start in most situations. The buyer's opening up a new bank account under their new corporate name, and then they're buying the assets of the company. And, you know, by assets, that includes any tangible assets, of course, whether there's equipment or inventory. But in addition to that, right, they're acquiring intangible assets too, right? The goodwill, you know, the customer base, you know, really anything else. So those are the main differences.
Yeah, they might pick up some limited liabilities too, like for example, personnel, right? I mean, obviously the staff comes with them if they want to keep the staff, maybe the office or the store location, maybe their automobiles, you know, these kind of things, right?
Absolutely.
If you're like most property management companies, you're looking for more ideal residential property management clients. Let Rentscale help you get there fast. The art of customer acquisition for any service-based business comes down to profitably generating leads at all stages of the buying process, nurturing them through education, and then converting them at an ever-increasing levels with sales effectiveness. Over 400 residential property management companies in North America have trusted Rentscale to craft their customer sales playbook, install a repeatable selling system, and train their team on attracting new property owners at profitable rates. Rentscale can also help you hire and train a top-performing business development manager to work full-time on your growing business. When systematized into a cohesive set of processes and people that bridge sales and marketing, the result can transform your business from a stagnant or struggling service provider into a new customer machine. Rentscale, the largest sales consultant and coaching company in the residential property management industry. For more information, visit their website at rentscale.com. Okay, what are we seeing today in terms of valuations compared to maybe what we saw a couple years ago, right? Interest rates were lower a couple years back. Maybe there was better access to capital. Is there a difference in the valuations you're seeing?
You know what? It's interesting. It's my industry is a very interesting one. Like I said, I've been in it long enough where I've kind of gone through a few different cycles, right? Of interest rates and, you know, good economy, bad economy. Our industry seems to be really pretty fairly stable, you know, even over okay. the past, you know, year or two where interest rates have jumped from, you know, 7% to 10% to 12%. What I found is there's always going to be buyers out there looking to buy, and there's always going to be business owners looking to sell, especially kind of where we're at now with, you know, a lot of, you know, baby boomers. I would say, you know, 70% of my clients are people who are looking to sell and retire. So they don't, they typically don't say, well, I know interest rates are a little bit high. Maybe, maybe there's not a buyer out there. I'm going to wait another 2 or 3 years and we'll see what interest rates do. No, they need to sell now. You know, they're ready to kind of move on to that next stage. So to be honest, you know, I've had, you know, I really haven't seen across the board and kind of company wide, we haven't really seen, you know, our deal flow slow down because of higher interest rates. So,
well, I guess the deal flow may not slow down, but I guess if in some of the, it's funny, some of the things, the scenarios you're describing remind me of myself because I went through this too, right? I kind of wanted to retire and do something different. You know, I got a pretty good valuation. I'm wondering if I had waited, if I would have gotten the same one today that I got 2 years ago. So I guess that's what I'm talking about. That might be a reason to wait is if in today's market, you're getting a 3 or 4 times EBITDA versus maybe a 5 or 6 times EBITDA, something like that, right? So I guess that's what I'm curious about.
Yeah. And I guess the short answer is no, I have not seen valuations slump significantly.
Perfect.
Yep.
Okay. So let's fast forward. You find a client, things look good. You've done your due diligence. You've come up with a valuation that you agree on with the seller. You sign a contract. Now, how do you go about looking for a buyer?
Yeah, there's a few different ways. You know, we're really heavy into marketing. And going back to what I mentioned, I think that's one of the advantages of working with a larger company who has the budget to really kind of, you know, put that money into marketing. So we're big on that. I would say we have three different marketing prongs, if you will. We have, you know, first of all, my personal buyer database that I've accumulated over the years. Our internal company buyer database, where anytime someone signs a non-disclosure agreement, they automatically go into our buyer database. And, you know, every 2 weeks, we send out an e-blast to, it's well over 15,000 people. Now, are all of them active buyers? Of course not, right? But we try to kind of go through that and keep it to people within the past like 2 or 3 years. So, you know, right out of the gates, when I get a new listing to bring to the table, that's a lot of people that we're blasting the new opportunity out to just from our own internal, you know, buyer databases. Mm-hmm. The second prong is more of a general approach where we market or advertise the business to the general public, right? And I assure my clients everything that we market to the general public, they sign off on it, right? Confidentiality is paramount to us. And so if we were to be selling your property management company, we want to provide enough information on the opportunity so a buyer has a pretty good idea of what they're inquiring on it, on what they're inquiring about. But, you know, we're going to leave out the name of the business. We're not going to say the exact location. So it's all marketed confidentially. And before we put anything out there on these different, we don't have a centralized MLS system like real estate agents do, but there are a half a dozen of these business for sale websites, which most business owners aren't familiar with. Because once again, you don't know what you don't know, right? Unless you've actually done a Google search, you know, buy a property management business in San Diego. You know, when you do that, these different websites are going to pop up. And we have, you know, subscriptions with these sites where we advertise our listings. Like I said, everything that we put out there is first approved by the seller. So they know exactly what's getting put out there. They're comfortable with that, right? So that's our second. It's more of kind of a mass marketing approach, I guess, you know, you could refer to it as. And then the third marketing approach is more to those strategic buyers, right? Who, whether we pull a list of industry buyers, it'll be more of a strategic or a targeted marketing, you know, campaign or approach to buyers who are already in the industry, seeing if they're looking to expand via acquisition.
Perfect. Yeah. Not too different, actually, you know, in parallel to the property managers that are listing, not too different than, all right, when you pick up a new property, you list it. You know, you mentioned MLS, you might list it there, you might put it out on Zillow, you might tap into your database of investors to present the property to, you know, it's really kind of interesting. There's a lot of parallels for sure. So I know that each business sale is completely unique. We've already touched on that a little bit in terms of some of the intricacies and some of the things you look for, but are there typical steps along the way in the sales process? So you find a buyer, the buyer seems interested. What are the steps kind of from beginning to end and working a deal?
Sure. Maybe I'll back up just briefly, right? So once we start marketing the company, we're going to have buyers inquire. As part of that process, you know, we're going to have them answer some initial vetting questions. And if they sound like they could be a potential fit, we'll send them a link to a non-disclosure, right? We have, once they've signed the NDA, we provide them with a confidential marketing package, or a lot of people refer to it as a sales deck or a confidential business memorandum, you know, confidential information package, whatever you want to call it. Not until this point does the buyer actually know the name of the company. You know, they're seeing some kind of initial financials, P&L statements. You know, I always include a pretty long list of like frequently asked questions that I know that a buyer is going to ask. Which they appreciate. My goal that I tell the seller is, hey, let's put some, you know, legwork in on the front end before we go live with the listing, so that when a buyer inquires, they sign the NDA, we send them the package, we've already answered hopefully 75% of their questions, right? It makes the business owner look, you know, organized. It makes the business look good. Not that it matters whether or not I look good, but it makes it look like they hired a professional who spent the time to put together a professional marketing package. Once a buyer reviews that, either they're not going to have interest, and that's fine, you know, but if they do, what's the next step? Typically, they're going to have some follow-up questions for the seller. Those typically all flow through me. And then if they like what they see beyond that, they obviously want to meet, you know, with the seller. And so the way that I do it is I want to be very respectful of everyone's time, including mine. So with technology now, it's, you know, very nice to hop on a Zoom call or a Google Meet call, a video call, where they can kind of do an initial meet and greet. You know, I always have the buyer tell the seller more about them and their background and why they're, what caught their attention about, you know, this particular opportunity. And then we have the buyer kind of jump into, you know, a list of questions. Sometimes it's 5 questions, sometimes it's 50 questions. I try to limit those kind of buyer-seller introductory calls to 45 minutes. If they're interested beyond that, you know, once the buyer's digested what they've heard and learned on the call, the next step is that, you know, we would, you know, walk them through kind of what does the offer process look like if they're willing to make an offer. And I want to make sure the buyer feels very committed and comfortable before they make an offer. And we potentially, you know, lock down the business and take it off the market for a particular buyer, you know, and then, you know, kind of just quickly, obviously, if the seller and buyer can come to terms on an offer, whether it's people start with the buyer, start with a letter of intent, and then that transfers over to a purchase agreement. But a buyer will then come and say, hey, you know, here's a list of our kind of due diligence request. They'll go through their due diligence process. A lot of kind of nuances and working parts, you know, as you go through the due diligence process, there's a lot of different things going on, right? We open up escrow, buyers working on securing new insurances. Escrow is doing their bulk sale publication to make sure the business is going to be free of any, you know, liens or encumbrances on the business. And it kind of is just, you know, buyer and seller, everyone kind of has, you know, pedal to the metal. We're trying to go through this checklist of things to get it ready to close.
Okay. From the buyer side, who's typically involved? Is it typically just the person who would ultimately be the owner? Do they have representation themselves, lawyers, CPAs? What's on the other side?
So my business is very different than like a real estate agent's used to, right? I think, mm-hmm. and I sold real estate for about 3 years prior to getting into, you know, business brokering. It's very common to have a listing agent and a buyer's agent. In my industry, it's far less common. I would say over the past 13 plus years, I've probably worked with, you know, less than 10, you know, brokers who are representing the buyer exclusively. So typically what we do is, you know, with the buyer, we have the buyer sign something, letting them know, disclosing that we represent the seller exclusively, right? So we have the seller's best interest in mind. As a courtesy, we're happy to offer them up a letter of intent template or an asset purchase agreement template. And, you know, we really are the one who quarterbacks the transaction, but really we're the liaison between the buyer and the seller. You know, educating the buyers, you know, here's what the next step is, but not giving them, you know, any kind of treatment as if we're representing them. Every once in a while, I will, like, I'm working on a transaction right now for a, you know, commercial cleaning company where the buyer has, you know, basically hired a company where they're not a broker per se. They're more of a business consultant, if you will, who's helping them through the due diligence process. They have their own kind of internal team of, you know, CPAs. They have their own legal term, and the buyer's paying them kind of as they go, kind of like an attorney, right? You pay them as you go. But yeah, that's pretty rare. And in most cases, I would say that I'm interacting directly with the buyer.
That's really interesting. Okay. And then what about the level of documentation that gets exchanged? I would imagine it's pretty in depth, right? You've got your client contracts in the case of property management companies. You've got your financials, you've got maybe other obligations, you've got contracts maybe with technology partners and things like that. What are they looking for? What do you want from the seller, and what is the buyer going to want to see?
That's a good question. And really that's very much varies case by case scenario. Sometimes you have a due diligence list and there's only 10 things on there, you know, mm-hmm. That's great. That's typically coming from either an industry buyer or someone who's, you know, been a serial entrepreneur and they know the 10 things that are most important to them, right? Other buyers who have never gone through this, you know, they're searching a Google search. Hey, like, what should I be requesting? I'm buying a business. Like, what should I be requesting for due diligence? And then you get a 5-page crazy list of questions that, you know, 50% of them don't even apply to that particular business they're inquiring on. So in that situation, typically I'll hop on the phone with the buyer and go through them and try to kind of narrow down that list to, hey, what are the really most important things that you want to see? But yeah, I mean, you already mentioned, a lot of them. Obviously, they want to see financials, right? They want to see, a buyer wants to see bank statements. They want to see insurance policies. Mm-hmm. If there's contracts, they want to see contracts. They want to see you know, generate reports from QuickBooks, you know, maybe like a sales by customer summary to try to identify if there's any customer concentration. If there's an SBA loan involved, that really kind of takes it to the next level of questions, right? Because you have, you know, bank underwriters who are, you know, asking even more in-depth questions. You have business appraisers who the bank hires to do the appraisal. The appraiser oftentimes has more questions. So yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, they've got to understand that, you know, if they're expecting to sell their business for, especially for a good chunk of money, you know, there's going to be work required on their part to make a buyer feel comfortable to, you know, take it all the way to the closing table. Just because you get an offer does not mean it's a slam dunk deal. There's a lot of steps, as you know, because you've been through this process before, that need to take place before you actually make your money, right? And so, yeah, I don't get paid. I don't think I answered this question. You asked it a long time ago. When do I get paid? I don't get paid until the seller gets paid at closing.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. So, I would imagine too, it depends on who the buyer is and kind of their makeup and attention to detail. Yeah. And this might be their only business that they're ever going to operate. Others might be buying up multiple, you know, businesses through a particular industry or something and be more willing to kind of take some risks. So that's got to be fascinating to sit in on some of those conversations.
Yeah, it is fascinating. I can determine pretty quickly how business savvy the buyer is, right? Uh-huh. Just based on the questions they're asking. Okay. Sorry. You know, if a buyer's asking certain questions right out of the gate that, you know, really aren't that important for them to know right now, I can tell right then that they're probably a less experienced buyer, which is fine, right? Everyone's got to start somewhere. And, you know, I'm always respectful of, you know, every buyer and every seller that I work with. I understand, especially if this is their first time going through this process, you know, they're leaning on me for my expertise because I've been through this, you know, many, many times. And I do my best to, you know, walk them through the process and educate them and give them a heads up on kind of what the steps look like so there aren't any surprises, right? In life, especially in a, you know, a big financial process and life process, like it is buying a business, it's a big life change. You know, no one likes surprises, right? They want to make sure they're being educated right along the way. So I really try to, you know, provide service that makes the buyer and seller feel comfortable with what are the next steps going to be. We're working together really as a team to get this to the closing table.
Okay. So then how is a deal typically structured? Is there money up front? Is that deferred? Is there a percentage, a split? Help me understand that.
I hate saying case by case scenario, but as you can imagine, it is very much the case here because, you know, when you're buying a home, and most people need a loan to buy a home, not always, but, you know, you're working with a bank in most situations on a home sale. So you're kind of confined to this little box, right? That, hey, if the bank doesn't like it, then there's no deal. With business sales, and that's why it's so important for me to really kind of gauge the motivation level of the seller, is that if we bring a buyer in and they don't want to get an SBA loan, or maybe for whatever reason, you know, we don't think the business is even going to be bankable, right? So our only options at that point are how much cash does the buyer have to bring to the table? And then how willing is the seller to carry a note, you know, assuming we bring them a good qualified buyer who they feel comfortable essentially being the bank for, you know, for businesses where there is a lot of recurring revenue, obviously we're talking about property management companies today. So we'll kind of stay on that particular industry. You know, most sellers, and it depends on the size of the management company too. If you're a smaller management company and you're the main salesperson out there and you are the face of the business, that's not ideal for a buyer, right? Because maybe they've liked working with Bob, you know, over the past 20 years, but when Dylan comes in as the new buyer, are they even going to like me, right? Everyone has a different personality and a way of interacting and a way of doing business, and not all personalities jive, right? And so, you know, there's a higher attrition risk that takes place if the owner is very involved in the day-to-day interaction with the clients. And so buyers, you know, are going to go through and analyze that as well. And, you know, what is the risk? If I feel like the risk is pretty high and I'm the buyer, I'm going to say, hey, Bob, I know you're asking $1 million for your business. You know, I've got $700,000 to put down. Obviously, if I'm a buyer bringing in $700,000 of my own money, you know, there's firm commitment. You know that I'm going to do everything in my power to continue to succeed in the business. I'm going to seek your guidance. I'm going to seek your advice as the seller. But if I'm asking you to carry $300,000, you're going to want to do your due diligence on me as a buyer as well, right? How solid does Dylan sound? And in that situation, you know, if you're going to be carrying a note, I mean, most buyers want to make sure the seller is going to be around for a proper training and transition period. And so there may be, you know, certain payout periods where, okay, I'm coming in with $700,000 down now, right? And either I'm going to pay you, you know, fixed monthly payments with this, you know, X percent of interest rate, or I'm going to, you know, after 12 months of the acquisition, we're going to look back and look at the clients that, you know, I bought from you at that time a year ago, determine where is my revenue at, you know, with those clients 1 year later. If we've lost, you know, 10% of those clients, well, you're only going to get paid 90% of whatever that balance is after that 12-month period. So there's a lot of creative ways that you can structure a financing deal. It all comes down to, once again, really matching up a good motivated seller and a good motivated buyer who are both looking for a true win-win scenario. And if we can find that, we can be flexible and make it work for both parties.
Yeah, that paying the 90% if you lose so many properties, that is commonly referred to in our industry anyway, property management, is kind of clawback, right? That's listeners may have heard that term. And then, you know, what I found is typically acquirers will want some sort of non-compete, that you're not going to sell your business to them and then turn right around, use the money to come in and start another identical business.
Always. You can guarantee that's always going to be in any kind of contract.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Hey, I'd love to keep going here, but in the interest of time, we want to wrap things up. I know you have another appointment coming up here. I think, you know, one of the biggest recommendations I like to make, and I'd like to see if you agree with this, you kind of touched on this already, so I assume you're going to agree with it, is that owners who are considering selling their business, make sure that the company can run on its own. You can't be still enmeshed in the business, to your point, if the clients are used to working with Bob or the owner of the business and that owner leaves, that's not a good scenario for the buyer, right? For the new owner. So, I mean, make sure you're working on your company, not in your company, and that it's running efficiently and could survive without you being present on a day-to-day basis. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that. And I think you would agree with the fact that that's easier said than done, right? Because you need to be able to scale the business to where you can get, you know, your first employee under you, continue to scale so that you can hire a second employee and continue to build your staff. So that essentially, you know, they become the safe face of the business. And when a client customer calls in, you know, with a concern, Bob's not the one answering every time, right? And so it takes time to do that, right? It takes time to, and you don't need to completely remove yourself from the business. A lot of business owners, you know, they're in business because they actually really like it, right? And so maybe they only want to come in and work 1 or 2 days a week, but even if they don't need the money, they like to be in there. They like the culture. They like the people that they've hired, and they just like the energy of kind of running a business. And I think that's a lot of the fun thing for entrepreneurs is, you know, running a small business can be fun. But yeah, you're exactly right. The more you can remove yourself from the business, the more desirable it's going to be, the higher multiple or valuation the buyers can be willing to pay because the business is not 100% dependent upon your efforts as the owner.
Correct. And I think particularly if you think you're getting ready to want to sell your company, those are some of the things you need to work on. You know, also tidying up all the documentation we talked about. All right. Listen, hey, this has been really great. In the interest of time, we need to wrap up so we can get on with our days here. So if someone, Dylan, wanted to get in touch with you to learn more about selling their business and your, what you do, how would they get a hold of you?
Yeah. You know, probably the best way they can look at our company's website, it's SD as in San Diego biz.com. So sdbiz.com. You can learn a little bit more about kind of our team, you know, our process, how we go about selling businesses. And my contact information's there. Obviously, they could always reference it here. I don't want to do a commercial ad and say, call me at, here's my phone number. Or you can find me on LinkedIn, right? You've got my name here. You've got my name here on the screen, and send me a message. I would say if someone's looking at the possibility of an exit within the next 3 years, you need to be talking with either me or someone like me now, right? So that we can do that valuation for you. As you go through that process, you receive, you know, free education, essentially. You understand, how is the valuation being arrived at? And if my valuation comes in at $1 million now and I want to sell it for $2 million in 3 years, what are some things that I need to do to kind of get to that stage? Some business owners wait too late, right? Where they don't have any energy and in their mind, they just want to be done. And that's fine too, right? I get that. But if you're, you know, if you have time and you're looking at selling, let's talk now, because oftentimes I can identify certain things a business owner can do now over the next 2 or 3 years, maybe just some small tweaks to make it more desirable for a buyer. And, you know, as we know, every seller wants to sell for as much money as possible. And so if I can help you kind of prepare for that, you know, a year or 2 or 3 years in advance, I'm happy to be a resource for anyone who wants to chat. So
That's a great offer. And I will put your LinkedIn, you know, link and profile in the episode notes for everybody who's listening. And, you know, certainly if you start early, the other thing is that avoids the potential for a distress sell. Yeah. If something bad were to happen, you know, the company or the people involved, right? So start early. I think that's a great recommendation. Great conversation today, Dylan. Really appreciate your time. Been an excellent episode. Thanks so much for being on the show.
You got it. Thanks for your time, Bob. Take care.
Okay, man. Thanks. All right. Talk to you soon. As we wrap up today, I'd like to make a quick plug to our listeners to click on the subscribe button, give us a like, and if you would, please pay it forward with a positive review. Thank you for tuning in to Property Management Brainstorm, where we are always working hard to find new ways to advance the property management industry, and we will catch you next time.